everybody. My name is Jennifer, and I'm a member of Deep Green Resistance. We are a radical environmental and social justice movement. For anybody that's not familiar with who we are, we have some literature, free literature, on the table, and some signed copies of Deep Green Resistance, the book, from which the movement that we're a part of was born from. Welcome to our talk, Countering Queer Theory. I'd like to initiate this talk by saying that I will be discussing transgenderism as it ties in with queer theory. It's been a fairly recent development that radical feminists discussing the issues of gender have been deemed transphobic. Queer activists have pursued this censoring with some success. Talks have been canceled at major universities, bookstores, etc. I want to state for the record, a difference of opinion about what gender is has nothing to do with hate, and discussing it out in the open has nothing to do with hate speech. Radical feminists have a very different idea about what gender is than queer activists. It's important to have discussions about this out in the open where people can come to their own understandings of radical feminism and queer theory. So moving out from that point, I'd like to take a look at what queer theory actually is, when it evolved in the culture, and what else is going on politically, because movements don't form in a vacuum. There's other cultural influences that are giving birth to them. And I want to talk about what queer activists actually say about their own theories. I will touch on the radical feminist perspective for clarity's sake, but this talk is more about getting to the bottom of queer theory and countering it as something that is vanguard and progressive. Then I'm going to review some history to give some backstory to the formation of queer theory. Afterward, I'd welcome some thoughts and discussions on this subject. My DGR comrades and I will be happy to expand on the radical feminist position of DGR. However, keeping in mind this is not a debate, it is a stance. Nonetheless, we appreciate your perceptions and comments. Before taking a deeper look at queer theory, let's look at how queer theory and radical feminism are similar and different. This will provide us with some context to the disagreement happening politically between the two. So, a few of the commonalities that radical feminism has with queer theory is an understanding, at least by some queer activists, that gender and sexuality are socially constructed. A recognition that the binary gender roles of feminine and masculine are oppressive. An understanding that gender roles are produced through performance and confirmed by their constant reenactment. A commitment to challenging heteronormative assumptions and practices. These are all things shared in common with queer theory and radical feminism. The differences between radical feminism and queer politics are huge. I'm going to just give you a couple of descriptions, and then I hope the rest of it will become self-evident for the talk itself. Radical feminism is a materialist analysis, argues that gender is not produced merely through discourse and performance, but it is a system within which one, gender male, has economic and political power, and the other, female, does not. And the dominant group has an investment in keeping it that way. Radical feminism involves an understanding that you cannot produce or challenge the system of gender merely through discourse or individual performance by adopting certain clothes, language, or even changing your anatomical body parts. This gives some context to the differences between radical feminism and queer theory. So let's have a deeper look at what queer theory actually is. Queer theory is an ideology that emerged in the 90s out of the fields of queer studies and women's studies. As a radical feminist, it is my argument that queer studies emerged as a backlash within the culture to the progress of what is now called second wave feminism. Queer has become part of the umbrella that covers lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer thought, theory, and activism, and it is also the umbrella itself. Queer is, by definition, whatever is at odds with the normal, the legitimate, the dominant. There is nothing in particular to which it refers. It is an identity without an essence. Queer demarcates a positionality in relation to normal. So what this sounds like when you break down the language is that there is no reason for its existence except its opposition to normal. In other words, it transgresses normal, and therefore it is. Sounds like a teenager. Or a rebel without a cause. If you romanticize oppression in this way, then you must have an investment in the system that you are rebelling against. You cannot be a rebel if there is no system to rebel against. Radical feminists want to do away with the oppressive gender system altogether. Queer studies focus on mismatches between sex, gender, and desire. It has been associated most prominently with gay and lesbian subjects, but the framework also includes hermaphrodism, gender ambiguity, and gender corrective surgery. I would argue that queer studies focus on these things in much the same way science studies the elements of our lives removed from all context. For instance, you have a scientist, he wants to study fungus. And he goes into the forest where the fungus lives. And he sees this nice, beautiful fungi sitting there, and he goes, that's the one I need. And he goes over there, and what does he do? He rips that fungi right out of the ground, away from all of its relationships, its community, and the forest itself. He puts it in his little baggie, takes it off in his car, takes it to his laboratory, puts it in a petri dish, puts it under a microscope, and now he's going to try and tell you what this fungi is all about, what this fungus does. At this point in time, this fungus is probably going to have whatever this scientist discovers about this fungi, it's probably going to have more to do with the scientist than the actual fungi itself. The fungi, in a word, is dissociated. I want you to hold on to that word because it's really, really important to the rest of the talk. You're going to hear it again, and it's really vital that we hang on to that word and really understand what it means. So Judith Butler, a popular queer theorist in her book Gender Trouble, argues for a performative understanding of gender as opposed to the idea that gender is innate or natural. Butler argues that the performance of gender itself creates gender. This is not at odds with radical feminism. Where we diverge is that she compares the performativity of gender to the performance of the theater. Radical feminists understand, as the audience and the actors do, in a theatrical performance, that in that situation, everyone gets to go home. Women being oppressed under patriarchy do not get to leave the theater. David Halperin, another queer theorist, states, while queer theory may now be recognized by many as an academic discipline, it nevertheless continues to struggle against the straitjacketing effects of institutionalization, to resist closure and remain in the process of, and I love this, ambiguous unbecoming. These are interesting concepts. Right? On the one hand, it sounds like queer opens up our choices and keeps them open in terms of exploring our sexuality and our gender. It sounds like a whole lot of freedom, a whole lot of fun. I mean, I love going to the theater. Don't you? And honestly, I don't want anybody telling me what I can do and what I can't do in my bedroom. So this whole concept of freedom wins the day with queer theory, and the individual's desire, no matter what it is, unattached to any sense of relationship, responsibility, or morality, is like a teenager at a party ingesting way too much booze to even think about what they are doing. This type of freedom has consequences, as we've seen with the porn industry, which is now a multi-billion dollar business. There will be a hangover. The other problem with these stories are that they negate the hierarchy of feminine and masculine and the feminine and masculine that you have to begin with in order to deviate from. This is the forest we live in, to get back to the analogy of the scientists removing fungus from their relationships in order to study them. We live in a hierarchy called patriarchy. As Lear Keith, feminist scholar and author, explains, the feminism that brought us rape crisis hotlines, battered women's shelters, abortion and birth control on demand, gender-neutral health wanted ads, sexual harassment laws, equal funding for girls' sports, and storming of the barricades in the trades and professions is now under assault. We are suddenly having to name sexism and all its harms all over again at a time when 1 in 3 women worldwide is sexually assaulted and a woman is murdered every 2 hours by her spouse. When the statistics on child molestation and abuse have skyrocketed and the porn industry is chewing up more and more women's bodies and lives every year to make more extreme films portraying women's debasement and humiliation for the masses. There has been an upsurge in the trafficking in women. Women of color are the primary victims of this atrocity as well as other crimes. Child prostitution in this reality is a tourist attraction. Queer theory would have us assume that this is all nonsense. Gender is about performance, and these old, moldy feminist ideas are dying to replace with a new progressive idea about sexuality that's not related to anything else. It is simply floating around out there in the ether. We're all free to be who we want to be. The idea that queer is not a fixed category or idea makes it very difficult to critique or understand. On the one hand, you have queer theorist Judith Butler explaining gender as a performance. This begs the question, why do we want to perform systems of torture? And here I'd like to quote philosopher, environmentalist, and activist Derek Jensen from his upcoming book, Anarchism and the Politics of Violation. Jensen asks, how did our sexuality get so far away from a means of expressing affection? Other queer activists and transgenderists argue that gender is innate and that some children feel like they were born with the wrong genitals. I can't imagine a world where anyone's genitals are ever wrong, and especially children's. But here we are in a world where it is happening right before our eyes. Let's go to another one of queer's foremost theorists. Gail Rubin is a cultural anthropologist, best known as an activist and influential theorist of sex and gender politics. She has written on a wide range of subjects, including feminism, sadomasochism, pornography, pedophilia, and other subcultures. She is an associate professor of anthropology and women's studies at the University of Michigan. In 1984, and you want to hold that date in mind because it's important, in an essay entitled Thinking Sex, Rubin introduced the idea that people feel a need to draw a line between good and bad sex, and they see it standing between sexual order and chaos. There is a fear that if certain aspects of bad sex are allowed to move across the line, unspeakable acts will move across as well. Society lacks a concept of benign sexual variation, she says. So what kinds of sexual variation is she talking about? One of Rubin's most controversial positions is her support for the practice of adults engaging in sex with minor children. In 2003, she defended this claim in one of her published books that the government's pursuit of child molesters is a savage and undeserved witch hunt. Anybody here have kids? She wrote, "Boy lovers are so stigmatized that it is difficult to find defenders for their civil liberties, let alone their erotic orientation. Local police, the FBI, and watchdog postal inspectors have joined a huge apparatus whose sole aim is to wipe out the community of men who, quote unquote, love underage youth." This is at a time in our cultural history when the amount of horrifying testimony we have from survivors of sexual abuse and what they've endured from having been sexually violated is staggering. Keith, writing in a recent Counterpunch magazine article, challenges queer and transgender activist and transgendered individual Joel Ruby Ryan. Ryan has written the terms female and sex class are offensive and passe. One might reasonably wonder, as does Keith, why Ryan is eager to claim membership in a group declared offensive and passe, or why Ryan got a job teaching women's studies thereby. But the bigger fault line here, Keith says, is between feminism and postmodernism and its offspring, queer theory. That a biological reality, female, can be called offensive shows just how far down the rabbit hole queer theory has fallen. What's next, she says? Gravity? And if female is passe, well, there goes life on Earth. Pat Califia is another well-known queer activist, described by Michael Alvear in a Salon.com article like this. Patrick Califia used to be a woman, kind of woman that liked other women. Now she's a man, the kind that likes other men. It just doesn't get any weirder than that. Oops, actually it does, he says. See, Calypia has a son, Blake, of whom he shares custody with his ex-girlfriend, Matt, who also used to be a woman, but is now a man. He stopped taking male hormones so he could give birth. Pat Calypia has admitted, not inconsequentially to this discussion, to being a survivor of sexual abuse. Calypia's work centers around recruitment, to use Calypia's word, into the queer lifestyle, which in Calypia's case includes tireless promoting, in both fiction and nonfiction, portrayals of sexual degradation, including bestiality, the eating of feces, and the routine torture of children. Short stories include, for example, a mother perpetrating a sadomasochistic sexual relationship onto her 13-year-old daughter, a school mistress torturing a very young child, which in the fictional story the child enjoys, and a woman being gang raped by police. Calypia justifies these views, writing in Macho Sluts, "We need the forbidden and the unspeakable." Really? Not only because it has intrinsic worth, but because it reminds us that we live in a digitized culture where we're taught to crave food that does not nourish us, cookie-cutter relationships, clichés disguised as inspiration, religions without ecstasy, secondhand violence, third-hand sex, two-dimensional lives that are three sizes too small. And I gotta tell you, I love that description of our culture. I mean, it's perfect, right? And she's right. Calypia's right about the digitized culture we live in and its attendant horrors. But like many queer theorists, Calypia prefers to act out the misery of our subjugation to the machine instead of confronting the powers behind it. This fits in very nicely with the liberal ideas about recycling and adoption of green lifestyle to stop the world from being torched and scorched instead of the hard work of resistance. So now that we've scratched the surface on queer theory, let's take a look at what else was happening in the culture at the time it emerged, namely neoliberalism or unfettered capitalism. And I'm going to be drawing here on the work of Gail Dines, author of Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality, and professor of women's studies at Wheelock College, and a kick-ass feminist. She is so awesome. I can't really do justice to neoliberalism in this talk because time does not permit, but it ties in so beautifully with the discussion. I encourage you to seek out more information about that. But here it is, it's the 1980s, and queer theory is just under the surface now. It's going to start to emerge in the 1990s, but here we are in the 80s, right? And Reagan is president, and Margaret Thatcher became the Prime Minister of Britain. This is precisely when neoliberalism hit the ground running in this culture. The attempt to build a somewhat collective society post-World War II got completely undermined by these two individuals, becomes a critical moment for the emergence of queer theory. Basically, what you have is, sweeping economic changes infused with a hyper-masculinity. The market opens up. There's minimal state intervention. There's limited social programs. You know, if you're poor, you're lazy. Free trade or neo-colonialism, where more developed countries can exploit the less developed countries. You have strong property rights for the rich, privatization or runaway capitalism, weak unions, which is translates to corporate control that destroys the collective power of the people. And basically what this morphs into is between the years 1979 and 2006, while the income of the lowest 20% rose by an average of 11%, the income of the top 1% increased by 256%. Woo! Thatcher says in 1987, there's no such thing as society, only individual men and women. And this is the exact same moment in time that Karl Marx rolled over in his grave. So the crux of all this, this sweeping economic change, and Thatcher and Reagan and the 1% The crux of all this is that we're all individuals. There's no collective or class interests. The individual is the primary unit of reality and the ultimate standard of value. Consumerism becomes the only way of achieving the individual reality. Competitiveness and the pursuit of a high standard of living has made sure that we can't resort to a spiritual or communal means of realizing self. We are caught in the whirlpool of an economic definition of happiness and thus have to turn to consumerism to establish our individual identity. So this is the period here where all our strong collective movements, African-American civil rights, radical feminism, workers' unions, they all start to fracture. They start infighting, they start separating and developing their politics around smaller minorities that all want a piece of the pie. And it's very, very important for radical feminism because you take this movement that was so strong and so gorgeous. I mean, I was there, I saw it with my very own eyes, and it was totally happening. And this wasn't an underground movement. This was a movement of women out in the mainstream culture. They were on the cover of Time magazine. They were in the news. They were critiquing the major literary figures of the time. And they were doing it relentlessly, and they were doing it out in the public eye. They were getting laws changed. They were getting all the things that I talked about earlier in the talk. The rape crisis centers, the hotlines, the battered women's shelters. I mean, this is what they did. And they did it, by having droves of women working on this constantly. So the movement starts to fracture in all this. And what you get is a bunch of, like, smaller movements, liberal feminists, black feminists, lesbian feminists, separatist lesbian feminists, cyber feminists, ecofeminists, individual feminists, feminists, lots of different feminists, but they're not all working together to dismantle patriarchy. Now they're more interested in their own little individual issues. So that monster of patriarchy is no longer getting it in the gut, right? So this fracturing is not an accident. This is an arrangement of power that was and is working very effectively within the culture to disempower the working class and other social movements that were making incredibly rapid progress for the betterment of society. So this is what we see, this hypermasculinity taking shape in our economic and political sphere. Men's studies theorist Michael Metcalf writes of how aggressive masculinity constructs the economy through notions such as that in the marketplace only the fittest should survive and that a hard, lean industrial sector is necessary. Michael Kimmel, another theorist, explains that American aggression and violence conform to this compulsive masculinity, a socially constructed gender identity that is manifest both in the individual behavior and in foreign and domestic policies. At this same time, we see gay males' sex subculture reproducing precisely the codes of masculine dominance of the mainstream world. So gay men's sex clubs, and particularly S&M clubs, and the parties that they have are all strictly organized according to masculine aggressive hierarchy. They are very explicit versions of the masculinity that presents a threat militarily, economically, and sexually to women and men internationally. As Metcalf states, male sexuality is not purely a private affair, but suffuses public life. So, this is a bit of what's going on politically. What is going on in pop culture at this time? 1980s. Who's the reigning queen of pop culture?
Madonna.
I am a material girl. Right? Madonna! Madonna is one of the main vehicles for the introduction of queer politics into the culture. As her career progresses, she adopts the hypermasculinity and worship of everything deemed male in American culture that has taken hold inside the subculture of gay men. She adopts the eroticization of objectifying sexuality and submission domination. Make no mistake, this is important stuff happening here. You know, you think about pop culture, you think fluff. There's nothing really going on there, right? Pay attention because it's playing out there too. And also she's putting these ideas to with strong visuals. I mean, she's using her sexuality. She's, you know, using song and music and vibrant visuals to convey her message. And it's working. She's very much embraced by the mainstream youth. So she's one idea, one vehicle for carrying the idea that submission domination, bondage and discipline, sadism and masochism are erotic to the mainstream population. Gay men in the fashion industry also at this time introduced bondage into the mainstream of fashion and photography. Think Christian Dior, Yves Saint Laurent, Armani, Versace, and many others, who also build entire collections around tattoo designs, piercings, and bondage wear. Sean Cole, in a wonderful article in QLBTQ.com, outlines beautifully the transition from feminine attire to the adoption of hyper-masculine dress that happens during this period in the gay male subculture. In the 60s, gay men throughout the Western world had begun to question their position as second-class citizens and their stereotype as effeminate queens. Along with the demands for equality and recognition, gay men began to address their appearance. In the 70s, gay men in New York and San Francisco looked to the epitomes of American masculinity, the cowboy, the lumberjack, the construction worker, for inspiration for a new dress style. Some of these men also developed a sexual taste for experimenting with sadomasochism. Consequently, they sometimes adopted a leather man appearance and style. So the eroticization of S&M is brought into the cultural mainstream by the subculture of gay men. But it doesn't start there. It begins in the culture at large, is part of the fabric of patriarchy. It is adopted by gay men, processed and utilized for the enlarged sense of power it gives them, and it is then sent back out into the mainstream through fashion, art, and music, and deemed vanguard. Body morphing becomes a huge component of this change. Compulsive piercing, branding, cutting, and tattoos all begin seeping into the cultural mainstream, especially for impressionable young people, artists, and musicians. And this is not only infiltrating the mainstream culture, it is also infiltrating, and much beleaguered by this point, lesbian community. Radical lesbian radical feminism has been fractured, and radical lesbian feminists were at the forefront of that movement. They moved everything forward in that movement. And so now, radical feminism has fractured, and they are without roots, without a resting ground. So what they start to do, and also AIDS during this time is very, very prominent, and the gay community is being derided because of that. And without a resting ground in radical feminism, lesbians sort of shift over and rebuild their alliances with gay men, which they sort of stepped away from because of their hyper-masculinity that they were developing, moved in with radical feminism, and then they moved out back again when radical feminism started to fracture. And now they move back into or move close to their gay brothers and support them through this whole AIDS crisis. But in the process, they also start to appropriate components of the gay male subculture, watching their porn, engaging in S&M, developing a male-worshipping mentality of sexuality based on objectification. They engage in the S&M theme and compulsive self-mutilation that is becoming popular. Lesbians begin doing drag king scenes, which are basically a mimicking of the queens, you know, gay men doing, mimicking women as queens. And they also start a practice called packing, which is basically putting a phallic-shaped dildo inside the trouser leg to infer having a penis. So this is how the ideas for eroticizing of submission and domination are being brought into the mainstream culture and also into lesbian subculture. But why? Why is sadomasochism being eroticized by the subculture of gay men? Sheila Jeffries is a lesbian feminist scholar and a political activist known for her analysis of the history and politics of sexuality in Britain. She's a professor of political science at the University of Melbourne in Australia. Jeffries draws a clear line in her wonderful book, Unpacking Queer Politics, between the emergence of body mutilation as fashion and sexual abuse. The industry of self-mutilation that has developed out of gay sadomasochism exploits the practice of self-mutilation in which young women cut and burn their bodies in private. This can include self-biting, skin cutting, head banging, hair pulling, picking at the skin, carving, burning, and interference with wound healing, to name but some of the forms. What is generally referred to as self-mutilation in mental health literature comprises attacks on the skin or bodily organs, such as the eyes or genitals, usually conducted in private and with the object of alleviating mental distress. Most varieties of self-mutilation are far more prevalent in females. Feminist researchers who have worked with or interviewed self-mutilators have found one explanation in particular for this: men's sexual abuse of children. Marilee Strong, in her interviews with self-injurers for her landmark book on the issue, states that nearly all of those she interviewed suffered some form of child abuse or neglect. Cutting is explained as a way of dealing with dissociation. There's that word again. Which is frequently a consequence of childhood sexual abuse. Body modification, or as the practices of self-mutilation are called by those who profit from it, has been developed in the last 10 to 15 years. Jeffries sees that, in the case of sadomasochism, this may simply be for personal gratification, a reenactment upon the bodies of the oppressed, the violence that many of them suffered in childhood or adulthood. The invention by lesbians and gay men, Jeffries states, of practices of extremely serious self-harm should be a matter of concern to those still interested in lesbian and gay liberation. Some of those being injured have clearly suffered male violence in youth or adulthood. Remember Clypea. Others have just suffered the oppression, bullying, and brutalizing that comes with the turf for many young lesbians and gay men. Gay men are a socially degraded group by any standards and have been immensely influential in disseminating the practices of self-mutilation. Men's involvement in self-mutilation can also be explained through understanding the effects of childhood sexual abuse. In the Journal of Internal Medicine, 1997, an article published on the childhood sexual abuse of homosexual men claims that in an ongoing cohort study pertaining to risk factors for HIV infection, who completed a survey regarding history of sexual abuse, 35.5% reported being sexually abused as children. In a 1991 article in the American Journal of Public Health, a study published on the impact of homophobia, poverty, and racism on the mental health of gay and bisexual Latino men, findings from three U.S. cities conclude the mental health difficulties experienced by gay and bisexual Latino men in the United States are directly related to a social context of oppression that leads to social alienation, low self-esteem, and symptoms of psychological distress. So is queer theory really the vanguard of sexual politics it claims to be, or is it a reenactment of the harm endured in a patriarchal society? And where does the self-mutilation end? If we look at transgenderism as an extension of these ideas, and it isn't a great leap, when you consider the amounts and types of surgeries and other medical interventions needed over the course of years to keep transgendered individuals with the body parts they have acquired so they can feel like or can perform the opposite sex. We also cannot forget the industries that are forming around these ideas that proliferate to support them and their need to be fed, very much like the pornography industry that came up around, that ran into issues of it being free speech and basically wound up on the table, everybody's table, with that argument. Freedom, again, right? Let freedom reign, remember? And now that's a, multi-billion dollar industry. It is attached to every major corporation. Banks, everything. Go into your kitchen, your blender. Porn is in your blender. Open your cabinet and get out some crackers. Porn is in your crackers. Porn is everywhere. It's eating women's lives. And children. In a recent British medical journal, reviewers of an article by a doctor writing about vaginal reconstruction in young adults and children express their concern that non-surgical means are not being utilized as a first line of treatment. In 19 of 23 patients, the surgical option was utilized first. They seem to be veering toward restraint when they write, "We were surprised to see such a young mean age for vaginoplasty." It is difficult to identify any indication for such surgery in early childhood except to relieve parental anxiety. I wonder how long this restraint can hold in the medical industry coming up around transgenderism. In closing, I want to draw on the work of trauma expert Judith Lewis Herman. Judith Herman said about the effects of being raised in trauma, "Whether we are talking about adults or children, it often happens that a kind of sadistic corruption enters into the victim's emotional life. People lose their sense of faith in themselves, in other people. They come to view all relationships as coercive and come to feel that the strong rule, the strong do as they please, that the world is divided into victims and perpetrators. It's both understandable and not atypical for abuse survivor to keep eroticizing and replaying the abuse. They believe all human relationships are contaminated and corrupted, that sadism is the principle that rules all relationships." She describes other losses involved through long-term trauma. Loss of basic trust, loss of mutuality, of relatedness. In its stead is emplaced contempt for self and others. Herman also says, "I've seen it happen so many times that people turn their experiences around and make it a gift to others. That really is the only way to transcend it. You can't bury it. You can't make it go away. You can't dissociate it. It comes back. But you can transcend it, first by telling the truth about it, and then using it in the service of humanity, saying this isn't the way we want to live. Not, to quote Jensen again, by eroticizing it, not by making a political philosophy and fetish out of it, not by valorizing it, by changing it."